You're listening to R&IB Connect Radio. Since 1868, sight loss charity R&IB has been supporting blind and partially sighted people in various aspects of life. But one thing that blind and partially sighted people in the community don't want is to be defined by their blindness. One person who lives life not allowing herself to be defined by sight loss is Caroline Casey, and she joins me now. Hi, Caroline.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm well, thank you. Now, you had an unusual upbringing in as much as you had severe sight loss, but you weren't aware of it.
Yeah, and that wasn't an accident. I found out by accident when I was 17 years old, when my father had given me one driving lesson for my 17th birthday, because one of my dreams was to be a biker chick, along with another like crazy dreams. But I discovered I discovered that I have a condition called ocular albinism, which I had since birth. And the reason I didn't know was because Dad and Mum decided that when they were sending me to school, that they didn't want me to be defined by my sight loss or low vision. And they wanted to see how I could manage in school if I didn't know. And so they brought me up as a sighted child. I just wore a pair of glasses with short-sightedness like anybody else. So I just thought I was like any other kid, and had no idea about the severity of the low vision that I had, which, yeah, was a big surprise at 17. But I mean, it's an extraordinary thing. I think I just grew up like any other kid, just muddling my way through. And I wasn't very good at any sport that had a ball included. And I didn't see the blackboard, but I adapted, you know, and just got on with it, really. Well, and, you know, often people think that the story that I had no conscious knowledge of my low vision is extraordinary. I don't really think that it is. I think there's actually a lot of people who, many people in the same situation as myself, I don't think it's that extraordinary, because I think we adapt. Human beings are incredibly adaptable. What is amazing is that I just got so far and didn't get knocked down. I mean, I used to cycle on a bicycle. I mean, that was incredibly reckless and dangerous. But my sight isn't as good as it was when I was 17. Definitely. But when I discovered it at 17, which is very unusual, because I hadn't grown up in my mind with the label of, you know, visually impaired or disability, I chose to hide it. When I discovered I had that issue, I didn't want it. And so I hid it. I didn't want to be defined by my low vision. I was a 17-year-old girl. I wanted to get on and just have a life. And I don't think any human being should be defined by one element of themselves or characteristic, disability or not, because we're a combination of so many things. And it's limiting to define ourselves by just one part of ourselves.
Which brings me on to archaeology, because you've a great love of archaeology.
Yeah, I do. I loved archaeology. And so when I went to university, the subjects I chose were archaeology and classics. Now, it's quite ridiculous when you look back. I mean, I'm now 46 years old. But when I think back to my 17-year-old self, choosing archaeology in the knowledge that I had low vision and I wanted to excavate was probably not the best idea. But I was very defiant there at that time in my life. I wanted to do those things, and I had to adjust. It took me years to adjust to the knowledge of knowing that I had low vision, and that was going to be a different, my experience of life was going to be different. It took some time. I mean, I'd lived 17 years without knowing. So it took me really about 11 years to understand there were certain choices that were probably better for me or not. Archaeology was not one of my best career moves.
Yeah, and it did, obviously the sight loss did impact on that, and you switched to business, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, so I loved the subject of archaeology, but excavation, it wasn't my strongest point because I couldn't really see the ground very well. After I excavated for a while and essentially got fired, I traveled around the world with friends to Australia. I came back home. I went into landscape gardening. Like, I'm obviously not learning, but I also, my father was an entrepreneur. And I was really interested in business. So I went back and I did a master's in business. I went back around the age of 26. And I mean, I absolutely loved it. I absolutely loved going into the business world. But once again, I never had a plan. So I went into that, and it was actually at 26 in university that very privately I registered blind because I wanted the free bus pass. I didn't tell anybody. I just wanted more beer money. So, and that is true story. I just wanted the free travel pass.
Oh, you came a bus chick.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Instead of a biker chick. I mean, it's
no, a bus chick. Can I just say it's not the same as a biker chick? But anyway, I got around, which is always good news.
Right, now, we're going to change tack now, because if you're sitting at home, you're not going to expect this, I don't think. But you ended up travelling across India on an elephant. How did that happen?
So, you know, we're sitting here having the conversation and I'm laughing away about how I got through those years, essentially ignoring my sight. But after my master's, I was employed by a global management consultancy firm called Accenture. And I didn't declare to them about my sight either. So I went into the business world essentially hiding it and not disclosing, which many of us do. Because I was worried if I told them that they wouldn't want me. So I was 2 years in that job, and I wasn't seeking assistance. There's so much assistance for people who have low vision or are visually impaired. And I just was so stubborn, vain, frightened. I don't know, but I just didn't ask for any help. And so 2 years into the job, I had damaged my sight temporarily, but quite significantly. And at the age of 28, I had to come out of the closet. And I had to go tell the head of HR that I couldn't see very well and I needed some help. And it was the first time in my life I'd ever asked for help. It's the first time I probably ever owned up to the fact that I was struggling with my sight. I'd spent so much of my time hiding it and distracting and deflecting and all the things that you do because you don't want to get caught. And from that meeting with the lady in HR, they sent me to an eye consultant. And that was the man that told me to cop on and grow up and stop being frightened about who I was. And he told me I needed to take some time off. And he said, look, this is just part of who you are. Why are you so frightened to own it? And he just said, look, think about what you wanted when you were younger. And I had dreams of being a biker chick for sure, but I also had wanted to be Mowgli from the Jungle Book and a cowgirl. So when it was that day after leaving his office, I was really heartbroken, actually. My confidence was at an all-time low. And I thought, well, okay, well, I can't be a biker chick and, well, a cowgirl, that's already done, so I'll be Mowgli from the Jungle Book. And it was that date in March of 2000 that I decided I would become Mowgli from the Jungle Book by travelling across India on an elephant, which I started to do on the 16th of January 2001.
It's an amazing story, but I mean, you make it sound so simple, but there was quite a lot of adjustment, wasn't it, getting to know the elephant and everything?
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. When you tell these stories, can I just tell you there was so much in between that moment of a doctor's office and then the 16th of January, because, well, how does one do that for starters? I mean, you don't just hire elephants like you hire cars, nor had I ever been to India. Did I speak Hindi? Nothing. And also because I'm Irish and Catholic and guilty all the time, I thought, well, maybe I should raise money, not just do it for myself. And so I set myself this insane target of raising $250,000 for Sightsavers International and the National Council of the Blind in Ireland. So I just put myself under the greatest pressure ever. But I met a wonderful man called Mark Shand. And Mark Shand had travelled across India at the end of the 80s and written a book called Travels on My Elephant. And I had fallen in love with that book in 1994. And he was the man I contacted, and he used all his networks to help me find my elephant in India. And her name was Kanchi. And I met her on a beautiful beach in southern India in the state of Kerala, on this beach called Kapad Beach, where Vasco da Gama had landed in India. And I had my first blind date, excuse the pun, with this beautiful elephant. And I learned over 4 months how to become an elephant handler or a mahout. And I was with six Indian men. We none of us spoke the same language. I couldn't see very well, obviously. It was 40 degrees heat, very high percent humidity. And I camped and slept beside an elephant every day. I started by cleaning up elephant dung and then graduated onto being an elephant handler and rode my elephant. Yeah, 1,000 kilometres. It was amazing.
And I read that your first meeting was really memorable for you.
You're going to hear my voice go wobbly now. You know, even though this is nearly my gosh, it's nearly 18 years ago. I'll never forget the moment that I met her, because for any of us who, when I finally came to terms or finally owned my own low vision, it was extraordinary how much the word no started coming into my life. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this, you can't do that. And I think what the most extraordinary thing is, I'd always wanted to be Mowgli and I'd always wanted to hang out with elephants. There was this moment in my life when I finally accepted my low vision and I got freedom. It's like when I put my head, my forehead to the forehead of the elephant. I mean, I instantly fell in love. But I realized that I had always had a secret weapon that I'd never used, or my secret strength, which was my sight and owning it. And I think touching my forehead against that elephant is, I realized when I fully was who I was, that all the world was open to me. Is that for years I'd been hiding so much of myself, and I would never have ever got to have that dream come true if I hadn't come out and said, I don't see so well. So it was more than just the elephant. It was me kind of touching foreheads with my real self, I think.
Do you think she realised that you couldn't see?
She was the most extraordinary elephant. She was an extraordinary... It was an amazing... I wish I could explain how extraordinary this journey was, that I got to see India on the back. I mean, I rode bareback on this elephant for 4 months. I saw this beautiful, extraordinary, complex country to the ears of an elephant. I mean, it's amazing. She learned very quickly that I did have certainly low vision. Elephants actually have very low vision. It's very interesting. And I remember she played a trick on me quite close to the end of our journey, because she could work out what I couldn't see. There were people often, you know, offing her bananas along the side of the road, which she wasn't supposed to eat. But of course, she'd whip out the bananas from their hands and eat them. But there's a very particular story. It was so hot. I had a towel that I'd have on the top of her head to mop my own sweat off my face, because it was just so hot, right? And the towel kept falling. And I used to give her a command saying, Iriani, which means, you know, fetch the towel. So she'd have to stop and pick up the towel with her trunk and flick it back up to me. And about 10 times in one day after she did this, the towel fell and I asked her to give me the towel back. And she stopped dead and she didn't give me my towel. And I was like, come on, can't she, you know, in Malayalam, give me my towel. And she was, it's as if she was going, oh, I don't know where your towel is. Can you imagine a human being shrugging your shoulders and going, where's your towel? And what she had done is she had put the towel underneath her front foot. And she was looking around at all of us to go, there is no towel. But somebody saw just the edge of the towel underneath her foot. And I reversed her and told her to pick it up. And then she literally begrudgingly picked the towel and threw it back up again. She's so smart. Extraordinary animal. Amazing.
And of course, you did get a little bit of resistance along the way, didn't you? A little bit of prejudice. But you did achieve your goal of raising money and it was able to perform cataract operations.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I tell you what, the greatest resistance that I got, well, actually in India, was it wasn't my sight that was the problem. It was the fact that I was a female riding an elephant. I mean, that was a bigger issue than my sight, which really just shows you it's the 6 inches between your ears, which is the greatest ability we all have. You know, it's our attitude. But what the other big resistance was is, I obviously wanted to raise this $250,000 for, as I said, for Sightsavers International, the National Council of the Blind. But no business at that time would give me money. And at that time, it was really big, as the beginning of the green movement. And every business, even though that National Geographic were covering this big expedition, and, you know, you can imagine a visually impaired, you know, Irish girl on an elephant gets a story. Like, even though I had a media profile, no business will come near me. They're saying, we don't do disability. Can you imagine? It's just an extraordinary thing. However, we did raise the money, and that's another story in itself. But we raised enough money to pay for 6,000 cataract operations, which happened in Shankara Eye Hospital in Coimbatore in Tamil Nadu. And one day I saw 100 people have that operation. And if you're visually impaired and you live in poverty in India, they discard you. So if you get your sight back, you can contribute and you're welcome back into the village. And that was an extraordinary thing to see happen. And often people would say to me when I came back off the elephant, they were like, are you not sad that you can't get that operation? And I got to say, no, not anymore. I didn't want that operation, because actually owning my sight loss gave me the greatest freedom. It's not easy every day. It's not easy. But I actually have found an awful lot more in myself when I accepted my sight loss than an operation would have given me, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I have heard that from a number of people. But of course, your experiences there and what you achieved has really focused your life since then, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the extraordinary thing is I came back off that elephant, and though Accenture, you know, were like, come back to work, they were amazing. I couldn't go back, Simon. I couldn't go back to work, because in coming to terms with my own low vision, I realised the extent of the marginalisation, the inequality that existed for the billion people in the world who have a disability. And I know this is shocking, but I had absolutely no idea about that until I started to own my own disability. And when I saw and understood what was happening, I was like, there's no way. This is my tribe. I'm part of a billion people. And I discriminated against disability by not owning my own. And I think when I came off the elephant, I was like, first of all, I wanted to change the narrative and how we understood what disability was. No human being should be defined by a disability. We're people first, and I wanted to do that. But the second obsession, which has been my obsession for 17 years since I've come off that elephant, was that I truly believe that the only way that we are going to be able to create an equal world for people with disabilities, or to revolutionise the way inclusion absolutely is in this world, is if business is at the table. I fundamentally believe that the 1 billion people in the world who have a disability are equally as valuable a market as any other. We are worth $8 trillion. We are consumers, suppliers, talents, members of your community. 80% of us acquire the disability between the ages of 18 and 64, which is the workforce. And what I really wanted to do is position disability equally on the global business agenda, and worked for years doing that. I really do not see that disability is a charity issue. I really do not. I think we are valuable. And last year, I launched a campaign called #valuable. And that was a worldwide call to action for business to recognise the value and worth of people with disabilities, but to position it equally on the global business leadership agenda. Disability is not about inclusion and diversity. It's about leadership. And that has been my obsession since my elephant.
And for the future, do you think things are moving in the right direction?
I'll tell you what, I'm really excited. I mean, I've been doing this now a long time, working with business leaders. I've talked to over 500,000 people. I've worked with over 500 companies and brands before I launched #valuable. In the last 17 years, I have seen brilliant, brilliant people, great ideas, fantastic initiatives, fantastic role models, people with disabilities out there doing their work. I think we have a great moment in time right now. There's a zeitgeist opportunity. It's so exciting because the voices of people with disabilities are finally out there. Social media has given platform, the digital revolution. I think brands are searching for purpose. And I think I think when we're starting to see when big brands like Virgin Media, if you've seen what they've done with Work With Me, that's a big brand, a consumer brand, which has gone behind and worked with a big organisation like Scope. You're like, this is when we can see stuff like this happen. I think now's the time. But I think the only way that we can make this difference, if the issue of disability is put into the hands of people like, you know, the Sheryl Sandbergs, you know, like if you give a really great business leader, a big brand and brilliant platforms, that's the way we can change it, working with people with disabilities. I think that I really believe that we could radically revolutionise the way people with disabilities are included in society. I think it's coming. And #valuable, I hope all of you are going to hear a lot more about it very soon, because we're trying to get 500 global brands to put this on their board agenda in 2019 with a committed action and put this in the hands of business leaders.
We will certainly look out for that and applaud you on the work that you're doing. It's an incredible story, Caroline, and there's so much more to tell, but we just don't have all the time. But thank you so much.
I might not see, but I talk too much. That's the Irish in me, I'm afraid.
Thank you so much for sharing a glimpse into your life.
Thank you.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio.